This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on, the language of race, class, and gender. How is it used and how did it affect the voters in election 2008?
But first, President-elect Barack Obama will assume office in January with an American economy that has lost 240,000 jobs in October and has shed 1.2 million jobs since the beginning of the year. The country and the world is sinking deeper into the quicksand of recession. Saddled with overwhelming challenges, the electorate has placed its hope in his new leadership.
So what are the first steps he's taking or should take on the road to addressing the economic freefall? Joining us is William Spriggs, Chair of the Economics Department of Howard University.
Bill, I have a critical question.
Okay.
Is it true that students from Howard University and Washington University there, but particularly from Howard, at 4 o'clock in the morning on the night of the election, ran to the White House and were screaming, "Whose house? Obama's house?"
And were you there?
You know more than I do. There was a huge celebration definitely on campus when the watch party saw that he won. And they broke out in song in the ballroom and certainly took to the streets around U Street. I don't know anybody made it as far as the White House.
What's some of your thoughts about this incredible moment in world history, really?
Well, it was very personal because I was so happy that my parents lived to see it. That was a big deal. I called them right away and asked them, did they believe they would live for this day? They were quite happy they lived to see this day. My father was a Tuskegee Airman.
Oh, wow.
So to go from your own country not wanting you to fight for it, and then you fighting for it and coming back to a segregated country where you couldn't even vote. I lost an uncle that, of course, I never met in World War II who was buried in a segregated cemetery. So much for giving your blood for your country and then coming home and, far from being the hero, being put into a segregated cemetery. So for them to live to see this day, I was personally so happy and blessed.
Mm. Obama's really got his job cut out for him. Two wars and a recession at home. And the recession actually has taken a new form. Before we were talking really about the financial crisis. Now we're talking about a recession. And now how bad is it really?
I think this is really bad. What held up the economy in 2001 and in the 91 downturn was the willingness and the ability of consumers to borrow money to bail themselves out. But now the middle class is tapped out. The value of their 401ks have plunged. Their home values have declined. They spent the last 8 years taking all the money out of their homes anyway to make it through the last 8 years with declining income. They are in a very precarious position. They don't have a way to really borrow their way out of this one. And we saw it in the consumer numbers last quarter where consumption dropped 3%, which was quite dramatic. The president faces a huge challenge that is unlike anything either President Clinton or this current President Bush faced with their economic downturns, that they won't have the help of the consumer to get out of it.
Recently, President-elect Barack Obama gave a press conference, again looking at the issues of the economy. One of the points that he pushed was passage ASAP of a stimulus package. I wonder if you could address your thoughts on what that stimulus package contains and what do you think it means to try to pass it as quickly as possible.
I'm not sure what it contains because I believe his team is trying to figure out what the package ought to look like. They're walking a thin rope. It's a situation where you don't want to incur deficits that will exacerbate problems further down the road. I think they will probably look at infrastructure expenditure because whether you're fixing a bridge this year or 5 years from now, doesn't matter that much. So accelerating the pace at which you would do that, doing it this year as opposed to 5 years from now, means that you can create the jobs now that we need them and not permanently increase federal expenditures. You just won't be doing that 5 years from now. But our safety net is broken. We learned that when the 2001 recession just let people keep falling. They didn't get caught at all. They just fell. The full impact of welfare reform has not been evident before. It will be now. Something has to be done about the safety net. People have been very sensitive, at least about extending unemployment insurance. They have not been sensitive in discussions about what to do about other parts of the safety net. I hope that they will pay attention to the rest of the safety net and not focus only on unemployment. But even with unemployment, the big challenge is going to be that the state of Michigan's unemployment fund is pretty close to broke now anyway. It's likely that some other states will face a similar situation. So hopefully there will be a mixture of fixing the safety net and providing the expenditures that aren't going to come from the consumers, and businesses are not investing right now. I think the plan with the infrastructure expenditure is to make sure that we are creating jobs. Simply putting money in the hands of individuals right now probably won't generate enough job growth. You'll have the leakage of people trying to solve their debt crisis, and you're going to have people buying consumer goods, most of which only exacerbate our trade deficit. I think in order to make sure that dollar for dollar we get the most, we need to figure out how to do that. Now, the big issue will be a lot of jobs are being lost now in retail. Those tend to be jobs held disproportionately by women. Construction are jobs held disproportionately by men. We're going to have to find a way that these jobs are distributed in a far more equitable fashion. Of course, if we can get incomes to go back up, get some people employed, retail may find a way to continue to hire people. But we need to be sensitive that taking an infrastructure approach clearly favors male-dominated jobs.
Bill, I'd like to get your thoughts on the auto bailout that's been proposed. The House and Senate leadership is in favor of it, and Obama is also. What's your thoughts on that?
It's necessary. And one of the big problems for Americans to get used to is the concept that markets fail. It's not to say anything bad about markets. Markets don't have perfect foresight. The current problem for GM and for Ford is more than the decline in their market share. Everybody looks at Ford and GM and they think only declining market share, and they want to bring up how, well, if they made cars we like, then they wouldn't be in this position. That's true, but the current problem they face is the dramatic drop in auto demand that has affected all auto companies, including Toyota, which is losing billions of dollars itself, and the credit crunch, which is making it impossible for Ford and GM to get the financing that would let them on their own make it to the next part of the business cycle. If we give up on having a domestic automobile manufacturing industry, then it's almost impossible to construct a way for us to grow, because automobiles are the last big-ticket consumer item left. We already run massive trade deficits in most consumer goods. This last 8 years, when people were buying homes and remodeling them, we more than doubled our expenditures on those types of items. But we lost 25% of our jobs in furniture manufacturing. We lost over 25% of our jobs in appliance manufacturing because we were running bigger and bigger trade deficits in those big ticket consumer items. If we don't have autos, then every time our economy grows, our trade deficit is going to grow, because the only thing Americans will be able to buy are things made somewhere else.
In terms of the meeting that Obama had on Friday to talk about the economic crisis, when you look around that room, it seemed very conservative to me. Do you think that Obama is surrounding himself with people that are too conservative for the job in terms of the economic crisis?
He had the mayor of Los Angeles there, and he had the governor of Michigan, and a very good labor leader and former congressman and David Bonnier there. So I think, as is typical of his style, he had folks from very different perspectives sitting at the table so he could hear from different angles what was going on. He's a brilliant person, does a great job of hearing both sides and figuring out what a good course to take. He does not like having people who are going to sit there and just be lockstep, because then he won't really hear what's the best argument on the other side. So I can certainly sense how one could look at the picture, which tended to highlight some very business corporate types. But as the lens widened and you looked at the rest of the range of the room, I think you could see the diversity that was there.
China has got a stimulus package as well. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about its significance within the global structure and its impact on recession.
Well, I think it will have a huge impact, and it's long overdue. It's about time China spent money on China. The big reason we have these problems is because they have induced this unbelievable forced savings on the Chinese workers. That $1 trillion that they had as play money that they dumped into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are part of our problem. If they had spent the $1 trillion instead on their own people building roads and modernizing their airports and buying airplanes, we would have been exporting Caterpillar tractors and Boeing aircraft. The world would have been far better off. You can't take $1 trillion out of the world economy and not have disastrous impact. It's about time they started consuming.
FDR has been floated and his picture looms large. 75 years later, a nation under FDR in not totally dissimilar circumstances. Any thoughts on how much President-elect Barack Obama should be reading up on FDR?
I think he should be reading up a lot on FDR because FDR's agenda was far broader than trying to some stimulus packages, which he only sputtered at. FDR tried to balance the budget, and FDR saw that the safety net was broken and fixed it by creating the whole Social Security Act. I think we need to modernize that act. The state-based part of the program, both the unemployment insurance and what we now call TANF, but was originally AFDC, state-based programs don't work. In the 1930s, they barely really worked then because people ended up being very mobile. You know, you think of the Oklahoma Dust Bowl and people leaving Oklahoma for California and opportunity. So we have to give mobility today to low-income workers who are trying to find a job. Sometimes the best thing to do is to run, and we need to give them that mobility by making their benefits a federal benefit. When you look at Katrina, the people who were drawing a Social Security check were the best off because they were free to go anywhere. The federal government was going to follow them, and they were going to get their check. That wasn't true for people in unemployment or on TANF. And I think as we mount all these bailouts, and the American government continues to acquire these assets, we're very close to $1.3 trillion. $1.3 trillion is the magic number because that is the current value of the deficit for Social Security. And I think we need to take that $1.3 trillion and instead of having it just be money that goes back to the Treasury, it needs to be dedicated to the Social Security Trust Fund so we can solve and settle once and for all that $1.3 trillion overhang that has to be solved by some president somewhere along the line. And then we can use the proposed tax that President-elect Obama had talked about during the campaign to be fair to those who were over the Social Security maximum tax, and use that to solve the household balance sheet. We need to put money into the savings accounts of all Americans, and the only way you can do that for all Americans is to raise Social Security benefits. I think we need to have some sort of small window where we do that, so we put back into people's savings accounts all the money they've been losing in their 401k and then value of their home. Social Security currently represents about a third of people's retirement wealth. They've seen the other part of it shrink because of the markets in housing and in the stock market. If we could increase the value of their Social Security benefit, everybody who's 48 and above is better off. And people forget the intergenerational benefit of that. If you're thinking about paying for college for your child and you just saw your 401k evaporate, you have to make a tough choice. Do I pay for your college, or do I figure out how to put the money back into my retirement savings? Can't do both. There's a big intergenerational benefit if we can put money back into people's savings so that they are better positioned for doing the other big ticket items like pay for their kids' college education.
Thank you for sharing your earlier story about your family at this glorious moment in history and for your insight. We have been speaking with William Spriggs, Chair of Economics at Howard University. And whose house? Well, I guess it's Obama's house now.
Yes.
That's a good chant.
It's a good chant.
Thank you for joining us, Bill.
Okay, thanks.
And now we're going to continue to take a look at President-elect Barack Obama. How did he do it? Well, in the aftermath of the extraordinary election, Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University, author and columnist for The Nation magazine, tries to parse out the Obama victory using the multiple lenses of race, class, and gender.
Professor Williams contributes to our understanding of how the electorate saw the candidates, their messages, and how Obama's candidacy overcame the historic barriers of racism. Let's listen to Professor Pat Williams.
I am delighted to be here. I'm just delighted to be on the planet Earth right now. I'm just... What a marvelous time. I wanted to talk about some of the way in which language was used during the course of this campaign. I think that this was a fascinating contrast in the use of rhetoric. And that use of rhetoric reflected some of the contradictory ways we think about race, about class, about gender, as well as a host of other issues. I want to be just a little bit academic about this to begin with. And both of them used a form of the first person, but you could really hear over and over and over again John McCain say, "I am this, I am that." He used a very first-person singular form of discourse, whereas Barack Obama from the "Yes, we can" to his acceptance speech where he said, "I did not win this, we won it," and then he turned it over to you. It was a very embracing, very pluralistic, first-person plural, a mode of address that engaged the youth, the larger community, and he did this over and over again. Contrasting that with both Palin and McCain's discourse, where they used not only the first-person, everything was quite singular. Real America, as opposed to all you others over there, but real America was constructed as very solid and very singular, all of one mind. I have the experience. Country first. Country was like a single package. There was a way in which also Barack Obama's use of the "we," because it was a kind of "you through me," was a communion. It was a rhetorical communion, if not a specifically religious one, and that fed into some of the high expectations we have because it sort of evoked not just the political discourse, but also the discourse of promising to be a kind of Messiah, "come to me and we will, you know, we will partake." And I think that those high expectations and that projection to some degree is something he's going to have to deal with simply because Barack Obama is and always has been a kind of centrist, but the degree to which many people channeled onto him through this rhetoric a sense that he is going to be our next Martin Luther King, or people used their projection to feed into the pluralism, but they are still within their heads about what that will mean, and it's both, for better and for worse, fragmented. The second thing that was at play in this was a certain figure of speech that, I know it's going to sound terribly elitist to use this word, prosopopoeia. It's a Greek word that, it's basically a figure of speech that means you take an embodiment and you turn it into an abstraction. Like the Pillsbury Doughboy is the embodiment of puffy goodness, and this is really what you do in advertising, is you take something and you turn it into a mood, or you take somebody and it becomes the product. It becomes an embodiment of an abstraction. And thus you had John McCain, the steady hand, became the embodiment of the steady hand, or the embodiment of all prisoners of war. Sarah became the hockey mom. Again, this singularity, this embodiment of a particular set of traits that sometimes were in complete contradiction to what they were on the ground. So, for example, Joe the plumber became a working class person who, at the same time, represented himself as somebody who was in a position to buy a $250,000 business, and seemed at the same time to really resent his actual status, which is $40,000 a year, having a lien, and actually probably better off with Barack Obama. But despite all of that reality, became the embodiment of the hardworking businessman who would be hobbled by too many taxes. Because he was operating at the level of the embodiment of an abstraction, it really didn't matter what his reality was. There was an attempt on the part of the Republicans to do the same to Barack Obama, to make him the terrorist, or to make him at one with Reverend Jeremiah Wright, or to make him at one with his middle name. He must be exactly the same as Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein, because his middle name would point us in this direction. And it was really, really interesting to me how his rhetoric relentlessly resisted this. He fragmented himself in very skillful ways. He didn't allow himself to be easily slotted by the media, so he invoked the immigrant narrative, which has always been a European one in our political discourse. And he turned it right upside down. You know, my father came from across these shores, and he deployed the myth of you come here and you can do anything you want. This has been an exclusively European story. I can't think of any other person of color who's been able to employ it in this way, except that his immigrant father came from Africa. It upended that particular story, played against it in ways that people couldn't frame in the traditional way. It opened up the category. Similarly, he said that I am the son of a single mother. Many people had to blink. You know, no, not not a black single mother. The category of single mother, you know, is almost automatically black single mother. You had to sort of rear back and say, oh my God, yes, his single mother was white, and she was on welfare. And this, too, opened up the category or made us rethink it, or it didn't allow him to be slotted quite so completely. There were also really interesting ways in which the archetypes of class got interrogated. Not interrogated enough, I think, because some of these are so powerful we don't even think about them. Particularly the Obama camp was so busy dealing with race, as has been indicated. That was a big enough problem. But I am really intrigued by the way in which class categories embed so many contradictions. So, for example, people talked about why didn't the Democrats really deploy or speak better to the working class? Well, I think that's because it's because we're still talking about race, and the working class is invisibly white. Underclass is African American. It's a class term, but it's really a racial term. It's really a cipher for race. Underclass includes the black working class, by and large, or the black working poor, whereas working class is almost an exclusively white category. Middle class is generally white and suburban. And black middle class generally includes any black person who has a job, or two or three jobs if necessary. And it includes a huge category of people that goes all the way up to Oprah Winfrey. Oprah Winfrey is part of the new black middle class, and I've been collecting references to this. And anybody, you know, bicycle messengers, anybody who has a job in the black community that is visible is a member of the new black middle class. They're never members of the working poor. They're never members of the working class. So if you have a working class that is unconsciously raced, and you can really think about that, then you have this relentlessly contradictory descriptions to which Sarah Palin appealed, in which the working class is endangered as opposed to the black working class, which is dangerous, or the black underclass, which is dangerous. So therefore, the white working class needs its guns, whereas opposed to a black working class person who has guns is somebody who must be put in prison at once. Where you have a white working class person, because they are so endangered and so on the fringe, so struggling against the odds and their sort of reverse oppression, that they need more kids, whereas black working class or underclass people need to be the subject of population control. And that's why I think you had this instant, what many people felt was a reversal, but I think is actually a continuation of a kind of parallel system of reference. So when Sarah Palin's daughter gets pregnant and has a baby, people are saying, hallelujah, God bless them for bringing yet another good soul into the world, and so forth and so on. But we all know that if Barack Obama had had a child old enough to be pregnant, we would have... He would not, well, we can modestly say he would not be president, yes, as a starting point. Then you move to, like, the upper class, which is completely invisible in our discourse of class. It's, you don't even have a word for this. We could have talked about, for example, Oprah Winfrey as in a manifestation of Horatio Alger dreams in America, but we don't. We sort of allocate her to the middle class. We could talk, for example, about Bush and McCain as members of the upper class, but they are so busy sort of covering themselves up as Joe Sixpack, you know, running away from this designation, and it somehow remains invisible. And so then you have this word elitism, which may be a kind of class designator. It's used rather peculiarly because, again, it is used to deny precisely, particularly in this election, precisely the people who are the Horatio Algers, who are the manifestations of coming from fairly little and succeeding beyond our wildest dreams. They are often the embodiment of the American dream, including Barack Obama. But that term elitism, I think, has to do with it, you know, partly is that it's been a very skillful product of advertising ploys to invert the meaning of good education. I mean, there's a sort of know-nothing undercurrent to it. But I also think that it is a resentment that comes from the fact that has resurged recently because we have such a lousy educational system. Finally, this was a rich discussion of gender as well, about the archetypes of women that were played through here. We had the angry woman, the scorned woman, and I really do think that Hillary Clinton's iconography as a woman who survived her husband's philandering and was going to do better than he was part of why so many Clintonistas were so disappointed, that there was this subterranean way in which they then ran to Sarah Palin because this was the sort of woman, you know, unlike Mrs. Spitzer or Larry Craig's wife, she was going to shoot anybody who philandered against her. And there was a kind of Thelma and Louise appeal to her gender identity that transgressed the fact that this woman is really right-wing. But I think it wouldn't have been quite as strong if it hadn't been on the backdrop of so many of these poor, miserable women standing there with the smiles pasted on their faces. There was an image of professional womanhood. There was the hockey, soccer, survivalist mom image. There was the pretty woman. And then there was the ugly woman, or several. If you went on websites, it was really disgusting. There was the image of the single mother, as in Barack Obama's mother that I mentioned earlier, this sort of newly vexed category. And then there were black women. And that's what I find most interesting as a category, which is the way in which Michelle Obama was relentlessly described as being a sort of black woman as opposed to a woman. The perception of her, you know, when she was dissed in various magazines, it was often called racism, even when it was in exactly the same terms as what Hillary Clinton has endured. It wasn't perceived as sexism. Again, that divide of sexism being something aimed at white women, but racism being aimed at anybody who is of color. This is something which we'll see sort of mature in terms of the Obama's ability to play with it. I loved the photograph on the front page of the New York Times as they came out to acknowledge his elect status. And the three women were very beautiful. And it's, you know, the daughters are beautiful. And this is such a contrast to the image of political black women who are largely invisible when they are political spouses. You know, Jesse Jackson's wife is very invisible. Who knew that Al Sharpton is married? I mean, you just never see these wives. I mean, they're church women, you know, little hats, or they're Condoleezza Rice, just very compressed, and they're always sort of single or lonely or widowed. And here you have this incredible, relaxed, wonderful, and she's adored by a man, and, you know, sort of this image of a hero. She has a prince, even. There's a black Cinderella in a way that many, many of us find very inspiring, in which she is black and beautiful in the promise of the 1960s sense. She's black and beautiful and not tragic. She is a mommy, but not a mammy. She is warm, but still cool enough not to be too easily girlfriended by just anyone. There's a kind of dignity and class to her that I think, you know, watching this family be raised is going to be enormously transformative as well.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Buildingbridgesradio.org.